This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, and we come to you Tuesday, July 16th, 2002. Ralph?
Maya, we've been listening, and we've been reading, and we have been following the media discovery that George W. Bush has been cooking the books. In the very origins of his business involvement in Harkin Energy and in Arbusto, and that the ways in which the accounts were faked and the loans were taken and the stocks were devalued and the profits were taken is analogous to what has been revealed about the major corporations in the United States. This is treated as aberrant, even as the Bush presidency is treated now in relation to this as aberrant in its behavior. But the San Francisco Chronicle on the 14th of July ran an interesting story called A Rich History of Corporate Crime. This fraud dates back to America's colonial days. Americans are perennially shocked, when the latest wave of corporate malfeasance hits the news. But fleecing the masses is every bit as American as barbecue or baseball. These things always happen. It happened in the 1870s, in the 1920s, and now you've got it again, said Nathan Miller, author of the book Stealing from America, A History of Corruption from Jamestown to Reagan. Unless there is some revolutionary change, we will have the same thing 50 years from now, Miller added. The common threads run through each chapter of corporate wrongdoing. Avarice capitalists and the political power brokers they purchase carry out their will and are in bed with them. In 1616, the article continues, the deputy governor of Jamestown fleeced the Virginia Company of every chicken and dry good that wasn't nailed down. When he returned to England in a boat stuffed with booty, he left the residents and investors with but six goats, and so it goes throughout U.S. history. In the mid-1800s, congressmen lined their pockets by legislating large public subsidies for railroad companies in which they owned stock, and they were paid by the railroad magnates. Deregulation of the banking system in the 1980s led to huge profits for junk bond merchants, and a $500 billion bailout of the savings and loan industry passed on to the citizens of the United States. Deregulation of the telecommunications and energy industries, as well as the lenient, absent regulation of stock options, contributed to the hijinks of Enron and WorldCom. The article continues, the trend in market scandals is that there is something fundamentally wrong in this economic system, said Brian Jones, director of the Center of America for American Politics and Public Policy at the University of Washington in Seattle. Each wave of scandal results in calls for stricter regulation, but either the reforms are weakened or the crafty capitalists find new loopholes. U.S. companies, the article continues, are regulated, but the regulation can never catch up. The government is behind, and it doesn't need to be behind, the article contends. And George Cohn, author of the telephone book size Encyclopedia of American Scandal, adds that there is hardly a company that is not compromised, that is not implicated, that is not involved in this process. So the article describes throughout American history the way in which this is operated. And it says at one point, the cabal of robber barons from J.P. Morgan, John D. Rockefeller, and Cornelius Vanderbilt played puppet masters with their unyielding control of industry, of railroads, of banking, and oil. The ambitious Rockefeller decided in the 1860s that the U.S. oil market was big enough for but one player, Standard Oil Company, and he stitched together a string of refineries and corporations under a holding company called the Southern Improvement Corporation. Those who refused to join SIC on principle were forced out. Rockefeller convinced his magnate friends in the railroads, including Vanderbilt, to double shipping charges of any refinery that wasn't part of SIC. In 1872, when Rockefeller was burnt in effigy and the SIC's charter was revoked, nonetheless he continued in a style worthy of Bill Gates to build his empire, the article describes. And so it continues to show that it is not this corporation or that president. It is not a matter of Clinton or Bush. It is not a matter of the particular corporation that is a vehicle for this fraud. It is inherent. It is a characteristic of corporate capitalism itself.
And so it goes. The structure of capitalism, the private ownership of the means of production and the exploitation of human labor by those who own the means of production. And so it goes. George W. Bush, the rampant insider trading and cronyism at Harkin Energy, and the entire development of George W. Bush's career. The Wall Street Journal, on December 6, 1991, in an article by Thomas Petzinger Jr., Peter Truell, and Jill Abramson, had a very interesting story, Family Ties, How Oil Firm Linked to the Son of Bush, meaning Bush Sr., who was then president, Won Bahrain Drilling Pact. Harkin Energy had a web of Mideast connections. In the background, BCCI. And the Wall Street Journal investigator stated at that time that there was, quote, a complex pattern of personal and financial relationships behind Arkin's sudden good fortune in the Middle East, raising the question of whether the Bahrainis or others in the Middle East may have hoped to ingratiate themselves with the White House. And it goes on, quote, even more intriguing, there are numerous links among Harkin, Bahrain, and individuals close to the discredited Bank of Credit and Commerce International, BCCI, a banking empire that used Mideast oil money to seek ties to political leaders in several countries. End quote. To merely call BCCI discredited is a gross understatement. As Time magazine, July 9, 1991, in a cover story, The World's Sleaziest Bank, How BCCI and Its Black Network Became a Financial Supermarket for Crooks and Spies, and How the United States is Trying to Cover Up Its Role. As the Time magazine reporters wrote, quote, BCCI is the largest corporate criminal enterprise ever, the biggest Ponzi scheme, the most pervasive money laundering and financial supermarket ever created for the likes of Manuel Noriega, Ferdinand Marcos, Saddam Hussein, and the Colombian drug lords. End quote. The CIA also used BCCI to facilitate funding of the Contras, the arms sales to Iran and Iraq, as well as the arms supply to the Afghan resistance to the Soviet invasion.
That's the euphemism for the terror apparatus of Osama bin Laden and Gulbuddin Mektekyar that was funded by the Central Intelligence Agency, created by the Central Intelligence Agency, facilitated through the BCCI and the various off-the-record corrupt drug money laundering banks that have engaged all of the people involved in the political parties of the United States, the Democratic and political parties.
At the end of the day, BCCI cheated depositors out of over $10 to $12 billion worldwide. It seems like a great deal of money, but compare it to what Ralph had mentioned before, the $500 billion of the saving and loan bailout that was organized during Bush Sr.'s administration.
And we have to keep in mind, Maya, that this description of the cheating of depositors out of billions of dollars is but the little continuation of how the funds of the United States government itself are stolen and deflected and directed into the coffers of banks, corporations, and the captains of capital. We have been instructed by the fact that the Pentagon has had to acknowledge through the GAO that trillions of dollars continue to be unaccounted for. $4.4 trillion at a time. In one given year, in 1999, $2.3 trillion had disappeared. The books were cooked. The money no longer there. 125 million Americans' taxes over a period of 1 year were, in fact, stolen within 9 months. The theft, the deflection of funds, the creation of BCCIs and Nugent Hand banks, which we will be discussing in a moment, are the constancy of a capitalism that treats the United States as its private whorehouse, that is engaged in a constant exploitation, profiteering, and organized theft with the color of authority. It is not a corporate scandal. It is a constant characteristic of corporate capitalism itself, and the state apparatus is there as but the milch cow. What the former Secretary of Commerce of Reagan called the corporate soup line.
Today, we are going to unravel through a timeline both the history of George W. Bush and Jackson T. Stevens, owner of Stevens, Inc., the largest investment bank outside of Wall Street, worth billions of dollars.
And not just as Jackson Stevens, the owner of Jackson, Inc., but Jackson Stevens has... Stevens, Inc., of course. But Jackson Stevens is a pillar of the National Security Agency, and a headquarters of Jackson Stevens operations is on not just Little Rock, Arkansas, but in particular Venice, Florida.
And just as we've talked about Lowry Cook, the former CEO of ARCO, Stevens Inc. is a prime funder of both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. And we will see how he ties in with our President George W. Bush.
As he did with President
Clinton before him. George W. Bush, following in his father's footsteps, created Arbusto Energy Limited, and Arbusto is Spanish for Bush. This was in Midland, Texas, and he did so with only $20,000 of his own money, not much for an oil drilling company. But George W. Bush's father and his aunt had significant friends. These were investors such as James R. Bath, the Houston aircraft broker, who, it's been said, has bought planes from Air America, the CIA air company, and who, according to the Wall Street Journal, quote, had a flourishing aviation business with the sheikhs of the Saudi Peninsula, end quote. Bath also owned a piece of a Houston bank in which Gate Tharone, who became known as BCCI's frontman, had been a controlling shareholder. Bath also invested money, according to the Wall Street Journal, in the U.S. for Khalid bin Mahfouz, the Saudi banker who headed the largest commercial bank in Saudi Arabia and who became a leading shareholder in BCCI.
But not only a leading shareholder in BCCI, but through Bath, who was a Central Intelligence Agency figure as well as a person connected to BCCI, Khalid bin Mahfouz was the vehicle for directing Saudi funds and drug-laundered money into Harkin Energy and into Arbusto, which means bush in Spanish. And Khalid bin Mahfouz and the people at BCCI are deeply involved with Osama bin Laden. Osama bin Laden is the brother-in-law of Khalid bin Mahfouz. The links of these people to Bush are not just in connection with Harkin Energy, but they sustain themselves through BCCI and through Jackson Stevens. And these are the very people who have been the vehicle for funding the apparatus that was used by the CIA of Islamic fundamentalists in Afghanistan that is has continuity with al-Qaeda, that has continuity with Osama bin Laden, that is in fact the nexus between the American ruling class and their instruments, their terror instruments, who are in reality part of the U.S. state apparatus itself.
And so Bath, connected to Khalid bin Mahfouz and the Saudis, became a 5% partner in Arbusto with an investment of $50,000. But he would do more for Bush over the years. The company soon foundered when the oil prices dropped. Bush, no matter what, never was a success at business on his own terms. In September 1984, given the collapse of Arbusto, it was rescued by Spectrum 7 Energy Corporation, which was a small firm owned by two Reagan-Bush senior supporters, William DeWitt and Mercer Reynolds, who later would prove significant to George W., as they were the major players in a syndicate that emerged and purchased the Texas Rangers baseball franchise. DeWitt and Reynolds made Bush Jr. president of Spectrum 7, even though he had been a failure at business, gave him 13.6% of the stock, and later arranged for George W. to buy a piece of the valuable Texas Rangers franchise. At the time, it was only a little percentage, 1.8% of the team. They, though, despite that, gave George Bush presidency of Spectrum 7 also, and later made George W. one of two general managers of the Texas Rangers, and gave him a bonus of 10%, just a bonus, not even having to purchase, of 10% of the team. Later, when George W. was governor, he sold his interest in the Texas Rangers, which he had had originally only an investment of $600,000 of borrowed money, $500,000 of which had come from a Midland bank, of which he had been a director, and he sold his interest for $14 million, and this was the money that made George W. Bush.
Maya, the Washington Post on July 14th described it as follows: the thrill of standing at the pitcher's mound on opening day as the new managing partner of the Texas Rangers Baseball Club was 1 year old for George W. Bush. Bush wanted to pay off a $500,000 loan he had taken to buy into the team. It was 1990. His father was president. The younger Bush was all name and no money, short on cash, but he had an asset big enough to retire the loan, a block of stock in Harkin Energy, a Texas oil and gas explorer. Harkin had bought out Bush's failing drilling company in 1986 and put him on its board. So Bush sold his Harkin stock, 212,000 shares at $4 a share, or $848,560 on June 22, 1990. 60 days later, Harkin revealed huge losses, which had been concealed, for the quarter ending June 30th. Its stock price plunged. The Securities and Exchange Commission investigated Bush for insider trading.
And we'll go into those details. On November 1st, 1986, as Ralph had said, Spectrum was foundering as Philip Uzielli, a Spectrum 7 director, said, quote, "We lost a lot of money in oil business. We had a lot of dry wells." So in stepped in Harkin Energy Corporation and bought all of Spectrum 7's 180 well operation. As Ralph had mentioned, George W. was given quite a number of shares. It was worth $600,000 at the time. Was made a member of Harkin Energy's board of directors, and most significantly, he was a member of a special three-person restructuring and auditing committee, which becomes of significance when the SEC later investigates Bush for insider trading. He was also paid, even though he was a director, he was paid $120,000 a year as a consultant. And he was given an added benefit of being allowed to purchase any further Harkin stock at 40% below face value, and was loaned $180,375 at very low rates, and possibly forgiven this loan later in 1889 or 90, when Harkin did forgive loans of his executives. He was loaned money to buy whatever future Harkin stock he might desire to purchase. So now, even though Spectrum 7 and Arbusto were financial failures, they provided Harkin with a valuable asset. George W. Bush was the son of the President of the United States. Now, it's interesting to look at who owned Harkin. Harkin's chairman and the head of the investment company that purchased Harkin in 1983 was Alan Quasha. And he was the chairman from 1983 until February 1991. He was the second largest shareholder, 20%, and incidentally, the largest shareholder of Harkin was a Harvard University investment fund. Talk about the close relationships between politics, the economic structure, and the universities. So here we have George W. on the board of directors, and as Alan Quasher said, you'd have to be an idiot not to say it's impressive. Who is Alan Quasher, besides heading the investment group of Quasher, Weasley, and Schneider? He is the son of William Quasher, a powerful attorney in the Philippines who advised two top executives of the Nguyen Han Bank. According to Mother Jones in an article by Stephen Piso, September-October 1992, Nguyen Han is well known as a CIA operation in Australia.
Maya John Quitney in The Crimes of Patriots detailed how the Bank of Commerce and Credit International, BCCI, the largest drug running and fraud operation in banking on record, had been involved in a scandal that had touched governments and their intelligence agencies, as Quitney documents, laundering drug money, financing gun running, bribing government officials across the world. On October 23, 1991, Bert Lance testified before the Senate hearing that Aga Hassan Abedi, the founder of BCCI, had been involved with the Central Intelligence Agency. By 1987, the international accounting firm Pricewaterhouse had taken over as the auditor of the books for BCCI, and the National Security Council and the CIA were exposed as being involved directly in the diversion of funds from such as the Sultan of Brunei and the sale of weapons to Iran and the anti-Sandinista Contra guerrillas in Nicaragua. And what Quitney points out is the following. What is notable is that in 1980, the banking scandal which broke out in Australia involved the same Pentagon and CIA officials. The Nguyen Han Bank, officially based in the Cayman Islands to maintain banking secrecy, was involved in laundering money from heroin deals, involved in the financing of munitions for terror operations around the world, and including former Green Beret Michael Hand, co-owner of Nguyen Han, who disappeared from Australia in 1980 and has not been seen since. Francis Nguyen, the other partner, was found dead in the front seat of his Mercedes with his parking lights flashing on an abandoned road in the Australian countryside. And it is instructive to look carefully at what this relationship is really about, because Jackson Stevens is at the heart both of the BCCI and the various functionaries who we find involved in the Nguyen Han fraud operation in Australia.
As Ralph started to talk about Jackson Stevens, it is at this point in George W.'s life that Jackson Stevens steps in, 1987, because Harkin Energy itself was a financial disaster. And Stevens Inc. soon stepped in and played a critical role underwriting a $25 million stock offering, which it placed with the London branch of Union Bank of Switzerland, that's Union Bank Suisse, known as UBS. Now, according to the Wall Street Journal, quote, Union Bank of Switzerland, which ordinarily didn't invest in small U.S. firms, would make an exception, giving Harkin $25 million in exchange for stock interest. And at the time, UBS was a joint venture partner with none other, I have to add, BCCI, in a Geneva-based bank. And also, UBS was involved in the very Nguyen Han bank scandal that Ralph had just spoken of. Now, the financing by UBS into Harkin hit a last-minute snag, and that was U.S. banking laws. So according to the Wall Street Journal in that 1991 article, Stevens solved the problem by bringing in a new patron. This was a real estate magnate from Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, who bought most of Union Bank's Harkin shares. He was Sheikh Abdullah Baksh. Baksh had business dealings with some of the most prominent people in Saudi Arabia, including former Saudi oil ministers Ahmed Zaki Yamani and Hisham Nasser.
Directly linked not only to Saudi intelligence, but to the Central Intelligence Agency, and involved in the funding of Islamic terror operations on behalf of the U.S. government from Afghanistan to Pakistan to countries across the world.
Now, Sheikh Abdullah was also a co-investor in Saudi Arabia with BCCI frontman Gaith Faron, who we can see appears over and over again. And he used Khalid bin Mahfouz, of whom Ralph is speaking a great deal, the principal BCCI shareholder, as his banker. Now, Bakhsh became, thanks to Jackson Stevens, Harkin's third largest stockholder with a 17.6%.
I should mention, Maya, that many of the, in fact, most of the Contra operations that were funded through, initially through Oliver North's involvement with the Nugenhan Bank in Australia, and then by BCCI, had their launching point in the airport in Venice, Florida. Venice, Florida, the location of the National Security Agency, the location of the office, the principal offices of Jackson Stevens Banking conglomerate, the location of his healthcare enterprises, Beverly Enterprises, the location of the flight school at which the presumptive hijackers Mohammed Atta and Al-Sheikhi and Al-Ghamdi were training at a flight school called Huffman Aviation of Rudy Deckers and Arnie Riethoff, long involved with not only the mob but with the Central Intelligence Agency itself, involved in Iran-Contra. These presumptive hijackers residing with Charlie Voss, who is an official who has been said to have been a flight operative of the C-130s that were carrying out many of these operations. This is the nexus. This is the structure. This is the banking behind the terrorizing of the American people and the real meaning of 9/11.
So once we have Bakhsh involved with Harkin as a principal shareholder, Harkin entered into negotiations for what could have been an exceptionally lucrative, exclusive offshore oil drilling contract with Bahrain. Now, you have to remember that Harkin was a very small company, had never drilled a well overseas. In fact, it had only drilled wells in three states, had never drilled in water, and didn't have any financial resources to enable it to carry out the contract. Its competitor of all companies was the behemoth Amoco. But in January, but as soon as Bakhsh came in, Bahrainis, the prime minister in particular, who was a brother of the emir, they cut off negotiations with Amoco and dealt exclusively with Harkin. And in January 1990, it was Harkin announced that it had been awarded the Bahraini contract, beating out Amoco and three other companies. How did the Bahrainis, how were they led to Harkin? As I had mentioned before, the Bahraini oil minister is key to this. His longtime friend was Michael Amin, a Houston oil consultant who had worked for Mobil Corporation as head of government head of government relations for Aramco. That's the corporation of the Saudi royal family and the U.S. oil company.
But Michael Amin is not only a Houston oil consultant. He is an associate of Bakhsh, the largest Harkin shareholder,
right.
And he was brought in by Jackson Stevens. By Jackson Stevens, when they substituted Bakhsh and the Saudi money and the BCCI for UBS in the operations involving George W. Bush and Harkin.
So within 10 minutes of Amin talking to the Saudi oil minister, it's the Saudi prime minister who's the brother of the emir. But here we have...
It's the Bahraini oil minister.
Bahraini oil minister talking to Amin. And within 10 minutes of speaking to Bahrain's oil minister, Amin got a call from Harkin's investment bankers at Stevens and Little Rock. And before we know it, Amin is leading Harkin delegations to London and Bahrain. And eventually, after the success of the contract, he got $100,000 from Harkin. Meanwhile,
that is chump change compared to the shareholdings in the criminal banks involved, where billions are being laundered. That's the afternoon drink.
Meanwhile, Amin was doubling as a consultant to the United States State Department, briefing the U.S. ambassador to Bahrain, Charles Hostler. So we have everyone playing all sides of the aisle. Now, as far as George W. was concerned, remember his father was president at the time, Monty Sweatham, who was Harkin's exploration chief, said that he talked about who the board of directors was, and George's name comes up twice. It wasn't a secret. That's what he told the Wall Street Journal. So here we have Harkin, which doesn't have any money, and actually had been reporting several million dollars losses in each quarter, getting the hopefully lucrative contract with Bahrain. This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial in New York and on the internet at www.wbai.org. You can write to us at Veritas, V-E-R-I-T-A-S 9 at, that's the number 9, Veritas 9 at Pacbell, P-A-C-B-E-L-L dot net, or at our post office box, Veritas Press, P.O. Box 6345, Vallejo, V-A-L-L-E-J-O, California 94591. Now, we prepared this timeline because it's difficult when you're reading the various articles in the newspaper. You get a little piece here and a little piece there. So we took all the articles and many magazine articles and lots of newspaper articles and commentaries, and we prepared this timeline so we could decipher who's who in the zoo and the intricate web around George W. Bush. And this web, as I said, leads directly to Jackson Stevens. Now, Harkin, as we said, didn't have any money. And so to finance the operation, they brought in the Bass Brothers of Fort Worth, Texas, who for a $50 million cash infusion became significant partners of Harkin. Who were the Bass Brothers? You've probably heard of them. They're large contributors to the Republican Party. Robert Bass is a member of Bush's Team 100, as Ralph has spoken of over and again. The Team 100 are the 250-some-odd people who contributed over $100,000 each to support the Bush presidential campaigns, Bush Senior's campaigns. And Bass and Harkin had hoped to rake in billions if there was an offshore oil find, but as of 1998, they found no oil. So meanwhile, Harkin is losing all this money, and what do they decide to do? Off-sheet balances, just what so many companies such as Enron and others, you know, the major corporations, General Motors, General Electric, all these companies do is they try to get their losses off the books. And so they arranged a sale of their Aloha Petroleum Limited, which were Hawaiian gas stations, and they arranged it to none other than their own chairman, Quasha, and another director, as well as other company insiders, who used funds borrowed from Harkin to complete the deal. Now, the SEC did notice something, and in 1991, they ordered Harkin to cancel the profits from this deal, restate their earnings, just as we've seen with WorldCom and Xerox, restate their earnings to reflect a $12 million loss for that year. Now, you have to remember that Bush, George W., was on the three-person restructuring and auditing committee that would have overseen this Aloha Petroleum Limited sale. Now, in April 1990, this is what it gets us up to, Bush and his, what Ralph had mentioned, the sale of his stock. Harkin is losing money continually. It is never making money. The question is, how much money is it losing? And Harkin President Mikhail D. Faulkner warns the board that the company has liquidity problems, this is April 1990, that would, quote, drastically affect operations. And a memo was sent out warning the company of, quote, a shutdown effective 30 June unless third-party funding is found, end quote. Now, the next month, Parkins financial advisor Smith Barney warned the company of its deteriorating finances. And according to the Stephen Pizzo article in Mother Jones, by then, Harkin owed more than $150 million to banks and other creditors. Stephen Pizzo also notes, quote, the U.S. State Department sent a chilling but still classified report to the National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft, and the report warned that Iraqi President Saddam Hussein was out of control and was threatening his neighbors, end quote. So here we have April. The president of Harkin is warning of imminent collapse. And in May, we have George Bush's national security advisor issuing a classified report about an impending war in the Gulf. Now, George W. prided himself on being a close advisor of his father, George Bush Sr., the president. So we have April, we have May, the next month, and a few days before the impending June 30th shutdown of Harkin, 6 weeks before the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, June 22nd, George W. exercises his stock option, dumps two-thirds of his Harkin holdings of 202,140 shares, is what he dumped, at $4 a share, and garnered $848,560. Now, you tell us that there wasn't insider information. He failed to report the stock sale for over 8 months until after the Gulf War was over, and then the SEC investigated for insider trading. But they let him off the hook. And as we've mentioned before,
Why wouldn't they? After all, you see, this is but the little continuation of the standard operational procedure. And very often, in fact, invariably, the people who are supposedly doing the investigating are linked to the very operations involved. They wear the same hat. They come from the same companies. They come from the accounting firms. And then they are engaged in supervising their own skullduggery.
And in this case, it was a very close relationship, because the SEC chairman was Richard Breeden, the former lawyer with the Houston firm of Baker and Botts, which, as everyone will remember, is very close to the Bush family. And the deputy counsel, Richard Breeden, had been the deputy counsel to Bush Sr. when he was vice president. Breeden himself received his SEC appointment when he was from the elder Bush when he became president. And the general counsel of the SEC was James R. Doty, who, according to a UPI report, neglected to interview any of the Harkin directors and had been George W. Bush's personal attorney for his deal involving the Texas Rangers.
And Maya, this, as we have been describing, involves the direction of Saudi funds, notably the Saudi funds associated with BCCI, into the Bush coffers. But the instrument for this, the person behind Bath, the person who is involved, is none other than Jackson Stevens himself. And Jackson Stevens, who is a multi-billionaire, long associated with the National Security Agency, who is in fact a vehicle for the development of the Promise software, which monitors the actual communications of all banks, which penetrates them, and which gauges their various operations around the world, the better to profit from them. This is the same figure who, with the National Bank of Georgia President Burt Lance, selected and involved Jimmy Carter in his campaign for the presidency. Carter, by the way, was a classmate of Jackson Stevens, and it is Stevens who arranged the public offering of stock, which would be the vehicle for the candidacy and the campaign of Jimmy Carter. Both in 1976, Stevens and Lance helped Carter in his race for the White House. Two Indonesian billionaires were then brought to Arkansas, Mokhtar Riady and Liam Sel Leong, close to Suharto, looking for an American bank to buy. Riady's agent was Jackson Stevens. And with that, with the banks that they buy, with the operations that they direct, it leads us to the scandal of Mena, Arkansas, drug running into MENA involving the Central Intelligence Agency and the bank vehicles selected by Jackson Stevens. In 1977, Burt Lance comes to Washington as director of the Office of Management and Budget. He quickly comes under investigation for financial dealings. His lawyer is Clark Clifford, both men revealed to be involved in BCCI. George W. Bush begins his operations in 1978 with Arbusto Energy, and he assembles several dozen investors in a limited partnership involving Dorothy Bush, a friend of BCCI figure Robert Altman, James Bath, as we have mentioned, and that very firm of Bath is owned by the Saudi investors, and the Houston's main bank is controlled by what? By BCCI. It is Stevens who brokered the arrival of BCCI and who steered BCC's founder, Hassan Abedi, first to Burt Lance, then to George Bush, and then to Bill Clinton.
In 1994, Stevens Inc. was listed as one of the biggest institutional shareholders in 30 large multinationals, among them Bill Clinton's close friend, Tyson Food, also Walmart and Altel, of which we will speak in a moment. It was Stevens who staked Sam Walton when he started Walmart in 1970, and he had financed Tyson's takeover of Holly Farms in 1988. Now, Altel is an important firm, as Ralph was talking about, because it's Systematics. Altel would get Systematics by refusing to sell 10%, Stevens sold a 275 phone exchange to Altel when they broke into the phone market and guaranteed in 1990 that Altel would get Systematics when Stevens refused to sell his 10% stake in Systematics to anyone but Altel. And Altel comes into play because it is Altel and Systematics that are involved in the software for the White House's, quote, Big Brother database, the WHODB, which contained as 200,000 names and was revealed by Paul Rodriguez in 1996 in the Washington Times. And Systematics also is connected to the National Security Agency, which uses it to monitor U.S. domestic banking transactions, because Systematics is the major supplier for wire transfers. It's the software that banks use for wire transfers and other back office clearing operations. The legal representatives for Systematics were Vince Foster and Hillary Clinton of the Rose Law Firm. On June 26, 1996, the Washington Post revealed that there was a banking crisis, and CIA Director John Deutsch called this a banking crisis because there were leaks that were taking place as a result of the software and a risk to the banking in the United States. But what Deutsch didn't reveal is that the reason for this was that Systematics, with the National Security Agency, had left a back door open in the software so the National Security Agency could monitor the banking transfers. And this was done with Stevens' Systematic software. And then the NSA would just waltz in. As a result, Citibank was subjected to a heist by Russian hackers, and it turned out that they were aided by the son of James Leach, the House Banking Committee, one of the investigators of James Leach's House Banking Committee investigators. So we've got back and forth everything relating to Jackson Stevens in terms of supporting not only Jimmy Carter, Stevens' wife, Marianne, was the Arkansas co-chair for the Bush for President campaign in 1988 and again in his next election.
By the way, Ron Brown's law firm, the former Secretary of Commerce of Clinton, who was killed in what was called an airplane crash, but as Jesse Jackson observed, and Dick Gregory at the time, yes, there was an airplane crash, but there was a bullet in the head of Ron Brown. Ron Brown was, and his law firm, were part of the funding that we are describing here, and it's interesting to note that the law firm of Ron Brown was the principal fundraiser for Dan Quayle, who became the vice president under George Bush.
So we've got Jackson Stevens supporting Jimmy Carter, funding the presidential campaigns for George Bush Sr. Now we come to his bank, Worthen, a bank controlled by Jackson Stevens and also Mukhtar Riadi. Now, Riadi had been brought in by Jackson Stevens into the Worthen Bank in 1984 when Riadi bought a 14% stake in Worthen Holding Company, controlled by Stevens and Arkansas's largest bank holding company, including 11 banks. The deal was handled by C. Joseph Giron, the Rose Law Firm chair who had hired Hillary Rodham Clinton. Now, in 1985, 1 year later, Worthen found itself in trouble, and Riadi came in with a 40% purchase and put his son, James, in to act as the president of Worthen Bank. So how do we get to Bill Clinton's campaign? Stevens had been supporting Bill Clinton as governor. And when Bill Clinton, in his 1992 presidential campaign, faced a critical cash problem, Stevens came in with an infusion of a $3.5 million credit line, which enabled Clinton to finish the primaries. And the Little Rock Worldwide Travel Agency, controlled by Stevens, provided Clinton with $1 million in deferred billing for his campaign troops. As well, Stevens Inc. employees gave more money to the Clinton campaign than those of any other firm except Goldman Sachs and the New York law firm of Wilk, Farr, and Gallagher. Now, you may remember that James Riadi, Mukhtar's son, was caught in the investigations of campaign finance problems connected to the Bill Clinton 1992 presidential campaign. And eventually, he pled guilty in a Los Angeles federal court, was fined only $8.6 million, and was said to serve 300 hours of community services, probably back in Indonesia. Ralph?
Well, Maya, what this really is about is the role of the Jackson Stevens apparatus in controlling the political figures in each party. In September 1998, a $63 million lawsuit was filed by Massachusetts Attorney Ray Coleman on behalf of former Green Beret William M. Bill Tyree. Now, Coleman is a former legal investigator for Attorney William Pepper in the Martin Luther King murder trial of James Earl Ray. And that, I should add, resulted most recently in Memphis in the jury ruling in a trial that the U.S. military intelligence was involved in the murder of Martin Luther King. But Coleman filed a 101-page complaint on behalf of his clients with affidavits and appendices in a far-reaching case involving United States government-sanctioned drug smuggling, murder, and cover-up of this. The defendants were former CIA director and United States President George Bush. In the Tyree lawsuit, quote, Jackson Stevens and Mukhtar Riadi were in business together, paying off politicians throughout Arkansas to look the other way and protect the CIA cocaine operation from Enmena, Arkansas. Statements from Colonel Carone were presented to substantiate the claim. Colonel Carone was from Army Intelligence. He died in 1990, according to an affidavit, having been murdered. He was the CIA paymaster and mafia-connected money launderer who couriered the huge amounts of cash in and out of the country. In Rodney Stitch's book, Defrauding America, he documents that Caron was a member of the Gambino family with close connections to crime groups in the eastern part of the United States, was the detective on the New York City Vice Squad, a member of the military, a CIA operative, and in Caron's affidavit, he stated, quote, Stevens, Riotti, and the CIA are in bed together. They own everybody. They have a lot of money. They get it done. I answer to Stevens. I answer to his money. I answer to the everyone else, as does the CIA. We need to get things done, and Stevens has the influence. Now, what this demonstrates is that the lawsuit has exposed the drug smuggling murder operations that compromise not only Clinton but Bush, that sustain a cocaine network in Mena, Arkansas, that was channeling drugs into the United States, the proceeds going to Iran-Contra, and the various operations that were the very function of BCCI and Nguyen Han Bank, as we have described. Here is an important and incredible aspect of this entire lawsuit. Colonel Caron told Tyree that Colonel Oliver North was working on a particular plan which would be known as FEMA, an ill-defined national emergency that would allow the United States military to take control of the United States to ensure national security. And that's a quote from Caron. Colonel Caron stated that, quote, FEMA stood for Federal Emergency Military Action, i.e. martial law. It was retitled Federal Emergency Management Agency because it would be better received by the population. Colonel Caron stated that, quote, we took drug profits, cleaned and laundered them, and in following the National Security Council, it was Colonel Oliver North who deployed these funds to create and develop FEMA. Oliver North's role in the creation of FEMA is documented in full in a book called Guts and Glory, The Rise and Fall of Oliver North, by Washington Post writer Ben Radley, Jr. North's work for FEMA was highly classified. Indeed, it was bizarre, and I'm quoting. The Miami Herald reported he was involved in helping to draft sweeping plans to impose martial law in the event of national crises or widespread internal dissent. This entire apparatus was put into place and is the very model from which the Homeland Security Act, the Patriot Act, and the current measures that Bush is adopting are derived. In the lawsuit, Tyree quotes Colonel Caron's testimony that FEMA is an off-the-shelf creation funded through the giant black operations fund, which came from the drug trafficking operations instituted by the Central Intelligence Agency, over which Congress has no control. The FEMA chain of command rules and regulations violate the U.S. Constitution, establish a succession to the office of the president that circumvents the vice president and the Speaker of the House of Representatives. This is the apparatus of repression that is in preparation to preserve this gangster rule of the banks, the intelligence agencies, the drug launderers, and the terror apparatus that is inflicted now on the American people. And all of this is by way of sustaining a rather interesting thing, that operation that has been just imposed on the American people called Operation Tipster, in which 1 million people, called Operation, under Operation Tips, Operation Tipster.
Well, it starts with 1 million people. Eventually, they expect 10 million people.
That's right. In the Washington Post on July 14th, millions of American truckers, letter carriers, train conductors, ship captains, utility employees will report suspicious activity. It is, as you say, Maya, Operation Tips, and the pilot stage involves 1 million workers who, quote, in the daily course of their work, will be in a unique position to serve as extra eyes and ears for the police and the intelligence agencies, which will offer them training to look for suspicious activity and a formal way to report that activity through a single coordinated toll-free number. And the Washington Post states editorially that to have the government recruit informants among letter carriers, utility workers, truckers, people who enter Americans' homes for reasons unrelated to law enforcement, people who will be not subject themselves to any scrutiny, who will routinely enter people's houses without permission or warrant is the apparatus of a police state.
So here we have the workings of capitalism. We've illustrated it today with the machinations of our President George W. Bush as he tried to be a businessman and as his father's cronies enriched George W. Bush with over $14 million. And also Jackson T. Stevens, controller of the Stevens Inc., with its hand in Tyson Foods, Walmart, the largest employer outside of the part-time work, the largest full employer in the country, and also controlling many banks and supporting the presidential campaigns from Carter, Clinton, and Bush.
Keep in mind, Maya, that the instrumentalities for this rule are the drug laundering gangster operations of BCCI, of Nugenhand Bank, indeed of Jackson Stevens apparatus, of the control of presidencies, of the manipulation of the banking structure, and indeed of the establishment of an essentially gangster apparatus that runs the state in the United States. The San Francisco Chronicle article with which we began spoke of the necessity for revolutionary change if any of these things were to be altered. Brothers and sisters, that is the task.
You've been listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. We look forward to being with you next week. You can reach us at Veritas, V-E-R-I-T-A-S, 9, the number 9, Veritas 9, at PacBell, P-A-C-B-E-L-L.net.